The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Oh my gosh, it is good to be back. I'm going to be speaking today and tomorrow. My second session tomorrow is at 2:50. And both of the speeches are from my new book, Atheism on Trial. Now, if you know anything about writing, you always come up with a good title and the publisher always changes it. Now, I couldn't fight that because Atheism on Trial is a really catchy title. But my original title for the book is closer to what it's about. And the original title is Nothing New Under the Sun, right? What Solomon said. And the whole point of the book is that all of these new atheists, right? Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and all these guys, they always present their arguments as if they're new. In other words, they want us to believe that what they're telling us against theism is based on new discoveries in science or history or psychology or philosophy or whatever it happens to be. But the fact of the matter is, there is nothing new about the new atheists. All the arguments that they make, that they think are knockout punches, have actually been around for 2,500 years. And so the point of my book is to show how these arguments are as old as the pre-Socratic philosophers, the Sophists, the Stoics, the Epicureans, the early church Gnostics and heretics, the nominalist of the Middle Ages, people like Spinoza. They've all been around forever, and not only have they been around forever, they have been answered forever by people. So today, I'm going to talk about the chapter where I talk about the good, the true, and the beautiful, and how relativism has taken over. But I'm going to show you that that concept is 2,500 years old, and it was already put forward by the Sophists of the 5th century BC. Then tomorrow, again, it's a little earlier, it's the 2:50 session, I'm going to be talking about the resurgence of Marcionism. Marcion was a very early church heretic, like 200, who argued that the Old Testament and New Testament were two different gods. And the Old Testament was this angry, nasty, spiteful God, and we got to get rid of him and only talk about Jesus, meek and mild. Does that sound familiar? Okay. We are completely returned to Marcionism, not knowing that the church already dealt with that and basically dealt away with it by a guy named Tertullian, who lived 1,800 years ago and decisively took down Marcionism. So that's what we'll do tomorrow. Now, today, any classical Christian school loves those three words, the good, the true, and the beautiful, right? And why? It goes all the way back to Plato. And really, those words sort of sum up all of the disciplines. Because when you're talking about the good, you're talking about the moral, ethical sphere. When you're talking about the true, you're talking about the philosophical and theological sphere. And when you're talking about the beautiful, you're into art and aesthetics in general. And the point is that there is a real good, true, and beautiful with capital letters, and they are all related. They fit together as a kind of harmony or balance. But over the last couple hundred years, we've had modernists and today postmodernists who have tried to convince us that everything is relative. There is no standard of goodness or of truth or of beauty. Everything's relative. Everything's man-made. And we have somehow proven that. And we have evolved from people that thought in absolute terms. And now we are more enlightened and we have accepted the reality that everything is relative. Well, folks, again, there is absolutely nothing new about that. 2,500 years ago, there were a group of people known as the Sophists. They were the enemies of Socrates and Plato. And all the way back then, the sophists were already teaching that truth and goodness are slippery and malleable. I'm sure you've all heard about the sophists. They were teachers for hire. And if you hired them, they would teach you how to use logic to win an argument, and they would teach you how to make the weaker argument the stronger argument. Today we call that law school, okay? So it's still with us and we can't get away from it. But this is what, and they would actually be hired to teach this kind of rhetorical skills, but they weren't seeking after the truth. They were, let's put it this way, they weren't teaching truth, they were teaching a technique, how to bend and manipulate the truth to win your argument, whether it was in the political sphere or whatever else it was. Now, most of you have learned the word polis, that's the city-state the Greeks would live in, Athens, Sparta, Corinth, whatever, Thebes, different city-states or polises. And what the sophists taught was polis-based morality. In other words, that when you go from one polis to the other, everything changes completely. There is no set goodness, truth, or beauty. It changes radically from polis to polis, from culture to culture, from empire to empire. Right? They taught this back then, and they were decisively stomped by Socrates and Plato. And then, of course, along came the Bible, and they were stomped even harder, and it took them a long time to come back. But they're back. And the only difference today is that they make more noise, right? They've got more media on their side. But the point is, there is no evolution from absolute truth to relativism. Both systems of thought have always existed side by side, but until fairly recently, the relativistic one was the minority view. I would say it probably still is the minority view, but again, they just have more power and more force, and they can sort of brainwash us a little bit better. Now, the best way to understand the sophists is by looking at the most extreme statement of the sophists, and it was made by a guy named Gorgias. Now, if that word sounds familiar, that name, there is a Platonic dialogue called Gorgias, right? And Gorgias was Plato's nemesis. And Gorgias propounded three propositions. I'll tell you to them, and then we'll talk about them. Number one, nothing exists. Number two, if it exists, it cannot be known. Number three, if it can be known, it cannot be communicated. Every aspect of modernism and postmodernism is summed up there. Now, when Gorgias said nothing exists, he wasn't like one of those annoying guys in, you know, rhetoric school who makes you believe that if I think the wall's not there, I can walk through it. That's not what he meant by nothing exists. What he meant was there is no origin. There is no center. There is no goodness with a capital G or truth with a capital T. There's no center or origin. Everything is just moving around. There is no beginning. Things are just here. There is no goodness, truth, and beauty with a capital letter. But the second part says, even if there was, even if something like that existed, we would have no way of knowing it. So they're doubting the ability of the human mind to even conceive of absolutes, even if they exist. So even if they're there, they have no bearing on our life. It's almost like an extreme form of deism. Yes, I believe in God, but I can't know anything about him, and I might as well just ignore it. I'll be a super agnostic, right? An agnostic is not an atheist, but they basically are, because they say we can't know anything about God, so let's just go on with our lives. Well, I call that functional atheism, right? So if it can be, if it does exist, it can't be known. And then if it can be known, if one of us was a super philosopher and, oh, suddenly I saw the light, I couldn't communicate it to anybody else because language it cannot bear that kind of truth. Now, that's basically what you've heard of Derrida. Modern deconstruction says that. There is no center. They even boldly say there is no logos. Right, they'll even use that sort of biblical and also Platonic word that there is no logos, there's no word, there's no center, there's no origin. Everything's at play, right? And again, there's no way to know it. There's no definitions. Nothing is true. And language is too slippery in any case to bear any kind of absolute meaning. Some of you have heard the phrase signifier and signified. Well, the signifier is just the word, and the signified is what the signifier points back to, right? So here's a picture of a tree. Here's the actual tree. But what the modern, postmoderns say is that even if you could trace the signifier back to a signified, if you can go back to some kind of origin, you know what you would discover? You would discover that that thing that signified is actually another signifier in disguise pointing somewhere else. And when you get there, it points there, and you never get there. If you live in a big city like Houston, where I live in, here's an example of that. You're riding along the highway, and it's always backed up because they're building a new lane. And you say to yourself, when they finish that new lane, oh man, I'm just going to zip right to work. Yay! And they finish the lane. And for a few days, it's fast. And then what do they start doing? They start building another lane, right? You never actually get to what you want, which is getting to work fast on time, okay? So everything, the way the modernists say it is meaning is perpetually deferred. You can never get back to an origin. To use philosophical language, a lot of you learned in school, there are two basic branches of philosophy, ontology and epistemology. Ontology is the study of the nature of things. What is God? What is man? What is nature? What is the universe? What is truth? It asks the big questions, ontology. But particularly starting with Kant, we abandoned any ability to say what something is. All we can say is epistemology, the study of knowing. How do I know God? How do I know this? How do I know that, right? And so we've given up on actually being able to say it really exists. All we care about is how we perceive it. But then in the 20th century, we even gave up on that and moved to linguistics, so everything is words, and then along comes Derrida and breaks down words. And so you can never get back to any true original meaning. Now, again, these modern people pat themselves in the back for being so progressive, not knowing that they're saying the same thing that was said 2,500 years ago. Okay? You're not really progressive, okay? You're actually regressive, if anything, right? You're way behind the times, right? So we move forward. Now, one of the things I'm going to do today, and I like to do this in my book, is to show that some of these arguments against God were actually answered by higher pagans like Plato or Aristotle or Cicero. And so today I'm going to focus more on Socrates and Plato, and we'll get to C.S. Lewis, don't worry. But I want to show you that these higher pagans, they were already answering these questions even though they didn't have the full revelation of the Bible. So I'm going to focus now a little bit on Socrates and Plato, though I'll just throw this out if you want to just play around with this in your mind. Those three propositions were actually answered, probably unconsciously, but answered by John. You know what we mean by the prologue to the Gospel of John? John chapter 1, verses 1 to 18. And the first verse says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So something does exist, and it has existed eternally, and it is God. And then, if it exists, it can't be known. John 1, 14, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, right? The incarnation is why we can know things, because the universal became a particular, but continued to be the universal. Amazing, right? And then, if it can be known, it can't be communicated. John 1:18, which is the ending of the prologue, says, no one has seen God at any time, but the only begotten Son of God, which is in the bosom of the Father, has made him known, or another way to translate the Greek word, has narrated him. Right? So I really do think that John directly answers that kind of relativism, nihilism that says nothing exists. No, it does exist and we can know it. We're not just in the dark here. We can know and we can communicate it. The Word was made flesh. But I want to go to Socrates. And if you only read the early Socratic dialogues, you might think at first that Socrates is a sophist. And some of you know that he was accused of being a sophist, and that's one of the reasons he was put to death, for other reasons. And I understand why you think that, because most of the early Socratic dialogues end with what we call an impasse. Socrates says, what is beauty? And somebody gives an example, a definition, and through that Socratic method, he completely destroys that definition and shows him he's wrong. All right, give me another one. Destroy, destroy, destroy. And then it ends. Oh, wait a minute. Isn't Socrates a deconstructionist? All he gives us is an impasse? Not really. The sophists are just playing with knowledge. They don't believe there's any absolute truth. Socrates believes there's an absolute truth, and that's why he's able to show us that all these other definitions are in fact man-made definitions and aren't true. But he's got a standard. And the only way he can convince his interlocutors that he's right is by arguing and showing them that their definition is wrong. Well, you can't really show somebody their definition is wrong unless there's a sense of a right definition, even if you don't know the right definition, that a measure exists. And that's what he does. He takes for granted that there is a measure or touchstone or yardstick against which you can measure all of these. Because if I want to find the truth with a big capital T, one of the reasons it's so hard for us to perceive that absolute divine truth is that there are all these little t truths. Think of little t's, right? And all of those little t's are blocking my view of the big T. So we need a Socrates to come along and wipe away all of those to clear the vision so we can start seeking after the truth. The thing is, Socrates stopped there. He didn't get much farther than that. But he did the necessary first step of wiping away or eradicating the false definitions, which are in fact man-made and polis-specific, wipe away those to get to a definition that can be true for all time and for all people. So again, now, one of the reasons Socrates got in trouble is because he taught young people. And a lot of those young people used the Socratic method to get a bunch of stuffed shirts and make them look stupid. And we all know that the greatest danger of the Socratic method is to get those 18-year-old boys that start doing it not to get at truth, but to show how smart they are. And that's a danger. We're careful because we're building character and virtue, but there's always that danger of making someone who thinks that the breaking of definitions is an end in itself, and it makes you feel smarter than the stuff shirt you're taking down. Now, a lot of times, stuff shirts do need to be taken down, but then they go too far, right? It becomes almost addictive. And that's what happened. And basically, Socrates says that. You're persecuting me for my students that went bad. And we all know that we don't have control, right? We do our best, but we don't have control. They sometimes go bad, okay? But I would argue that the difference between Socrates and Plato is that Socrates, again, wiped the field clean, wiped the blackboard, if you would, so Plato could come along and start coming up with real definitions, start moving towards that which is good, true. And he's the one that uses that phrase. He's also the one that gave us the phrase beatific vision, which good Christians try to seek the beatific vision. The difference is that our beatific vision is a personal triune God, not just an abstract form or idea. But Plato got it right. Plato got a lot of things right. It's pretty amazing. Okay. Now, Plato's most famous dialogue is the Republic. And the whole point of the Republic is answering a question: what is justice? Which is to say, is there a universal definition for justice? Justice with a capital J. And book one and most of book two of the Republic reads like an early Socratic dialogue because somebody suggests a definition. Justice is doing good to your friends and bad to your enemies. Oh, that's good. Let's test that. And so we start having questions and all that sort of stuff, and we realize that that's a false definition. It doesn't work, right? Then, some of you know, along comes a rather crazy guy named Thrasymachus, and he says justice is the will of the stronger, or the interest of the stronger, or as we say today, might makes right, Machiavellian, as we say today. And again, Socrates tries to take apart that. Now, if we had stopped there, it would have been like an early dialogue. But that's not what we do in the Republic. Once we have wiped away the false definitions, let's start moving towards a true definition. Let's start understanding that justice is a kind of harmony, not only between the different classes of a civilization or of a polis, but the parts of our soul. That's what justice is. And Plato is so brave. There is a student in there, Glaucon, who is on Plato's side, or Socrates' side, but he wants to ask the difficult question. And so he says, okay, what I'm going to do. He's a pretty good looking guy. Look at that. So, okay. See? Okay. Anyway, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Anyway, but it's very distracting. But anyway, basically what Glaucon says is, all right, Socrates, I'm going to play devil's advocate. We still use that phrase, right? I'm going to play devil's advocate. I'm going to give you a scenario, and I want you to disprove me, and I want you to disprove me. I want to make it hard on you. And he says, let's take two people. We're going to take a perfectly unjust man, but through basically sophistry, he convinces everyone that he's just and becomes a great ruler. Then we're going to take a perfectly just man, but everybody actually believes he's unjust. He is shunned, thrown out, and eventually killed. Now, Plato certainly has his own master, Socrates, in mind, but as Christians, we can't help but read that as a sort of pagan prophecy or foreshadowing of Christ, the ultimately just man who was killed on the cross. Now, how do you get your way out of that? But Plato's not afraid. He starts to dig in deeper. And he starts to say that justice is something in the soul, right? We've got three parts of our soul. The appetitive part, the I want, the id, right? I want. We've got the rational part that is more angelic. And then we've got the spirited part, the part of our chest that balances between the two. And he explains to him that when you're a tyrant, what happens is your base or appetitive part takes over because there's no longer any rational side that's stopping you. Because when you're a tyrant, nobody tells you what to do. You're above the law. You're above everything. And what happens is that when you become an absolute tyrant, you become an absolute slave to your own base desires and sort of bestial needs. And whenever we listen to our desires and our lusts, it always destroys us in the end. So the ultimate tyrant is the ultimate slave. And again, he works his way very slowly to show us that. And he says that the only way to have a good society is to have a philosopher king, right? And he works out this very, very slowly and shows that, again, we know it. And you know, we can't even have a discussion about definition unless a real definition exists. We may not get there, but again, if everything's ultimately in free play, you can't really have a dialogue. We'll talk about this a little bit more in a second. Now, what I love about Plato is despite the fact that he said, I'm going to throw the poets out of my republic. I'm an English professor, remember? Okay. Plato was one of the greatest poets in the history of the world. And what's so wonderful about Plato is that he will often make an argument using logic and the dialectic, as we call it, but then he'll take that same argument and incarnate it in what's called a myth or an allegory. And that's basically the same word in Greek, the myth of Ur, the allegory of the cave. It's the same basic idea. He's telling a mythic story that's either about origins or about final destinations. Almost all of his things are about the nature of reality, where we came from, where we're going. And most of you know his most famous allegory or myth is the allegory of the cave. And he uses this to help us understand the nature of our world and the nature of knowledge. And most of you know this. We are all like prisoners, right, who are chained inside a deep, dark cave. So the cave goes all the way down here, and that's the back wall of the cave. And we are all chained in chairs, perpetually looking forward at the back of the cave. Now, behind me is a roaring fire. I can't see it, but there's a roaring fire behind me. And in between our backs and the roaring fire are puppeteers. They have puppets of all the things outside the cave. Trees and dogs and cats and people and sky and all sorts of things. And in a weird way, goodness, truth. They've got imitations of everything that's in the real world. And they keep parading them. And as they parade their puppets, the fire casts the shadows of the puppets on the wall. And all of our life, we think that that's reality, not being aware that what we think is real is the shadow of a shadow, the imitation of an imitation, because even the puppets themselves are an imitation. But because that's all we've ever known, we think that's reality. But then one day, the person who will become the philosopher somehow breaks his chains and turns around, and immediately he's blinded by the fire. and it's painful. But slowly, as his eyes adjust, he starts to see what's going on and starts to see that they're not even real, they're puppets. And he starts to worry about the nature of reality. And eventually he goes outside of the cave and he realizes that the real things are out there. What he thought was real is the imitation of an imitation. But there are real, we've all been trapped in the Matrix, if you ever saw that movie, right? And what Plato says is, the guy that goes outside and actually sees the real things, that's the philosopher, and it's his duty, we almost might say his Christian duty, it's his duty to come back into the cave and try to enlighten the other prisoners. And Plato tells us what will happen to that guy. He'll annoy everybody, and then they'll kill him. Again, thinking once again of Plato, and maybe some teachers in this room, myself included, okay, because we keep annoying them, okay? I like to annoy my students. Have you ever tried to annoy your students who are interested in, say, education, and you ask them, well, what does it mean to teach people? What does it mean? Nobody wants to think about anything, right? They just want to do it, but you want to make them think about it until you drive them crazy, but you got to do it, right? What did Socrates call himself? A gadfly poking at you? Some of us might get swatted, the big fly swatter, but we'll die nobly, right? So it is that philosopher who needs to be king. And a lot of people misunderstand. Why did Plato say philosophers have to be kings? Well, he was writing his resume, but other than that, okay? Why did he say that? The philosopher is king not because he's, quote, smarter than everyone else. That's not the reason. The reason a philosopher needs to be king is because the true philosopher has got a perception, has seen goodness, truth, beauty, justice in its real form, and that's why they can make good judgments as rulers of the city, because they have a standard against which to measure everything else. The crowd is mesmerized by shadows, but the true philosopher, and that's why, again, you know, so many schools in America have what's called a cafeteria plan. Choose whatever you want, right? They don't trust us to know what they need to read. Could you imagine if you went to the doctor and the doctor said, told you you're sick, and the doctor laid out 15 pills and says, go ahead and choose one. Okay, I mean, hopefully we trust that the doctor has some perception of what drugs are needed for what thing and their side effects and all that sort of stuff, right? Unless they've been paid by the pharmaceutical companies, but we won't go there. But anyway, I only trust the homeschooling mom for my drugs from now on, that's it. I don't trust, because all the doctors are in the pockets of the pharmaceuticals. But anyway, the philosopher is king because he has seen the truth or some of the truth and therefore has a measure against which to judge. Now, a lot of people that read Plato's Republic think, oh, this is the most idealistic, naive thing I've ever read. It's got nothing to do with the real life. Well, guess what, folks? A lot of people don't think about it this way. But throughout the Middle Ages, throughout the Christian Middle Ages, for almost 1,000 years, who really ruled society? It wasn't the kings and the princes. It wasn't even the Holy Roman Emperor. The people that really ruled everything were the bishops, the priests, the monks, okay, that kind of stuff. And sometimes they were bad, but they were at the center. They were the philosopher kings. And what did they spend their life doing? They spent much of their life in meditation. And meditation, not because they were Buddhist monks, but meditating on the truth. You know? Now, I think meditation is cool, but a lot of Eastern meditation is looking inward to yourself and finding strength. No. This is meditation on the good, the true, and the beautiful, on what is real and what is really real and truly true. And they realized that those people were better at sort of controlling society, or at least shaping it, because they spent their life looking at the reality of things. And you know that Plato said the best life was the life of contemplation. And a lot of people have this idea that Aristotle was the opposite of Plato. But Aristotle in Nicomachean Ethics also says the best life is the life of contemplation. So he agreed, I think he agreed with Plato on more than he disagreed, actually. They both believed that there were real standards. The only difference was Plato put his forms up there and Aristotle put his form inside. Everything has a telos, a purposeful end. Right? But they both believe that there is a good, true, and beautiful. All right, Aristotle's a little bit more practical. But again, for Aristotle, you can't know a thing unless you know its purpose. And to know its purpose is to know its purposeful end, its telos. And all of that is mixed in with real standards of goodness, truth, and beauty. Now, what's interesting is, I told you, these two antagonists have always existed. Even during the High Middle Ages, when Plato was so strong and all that, there was a group of people called nominalists, right? Now, think about when someone says a nominal fee. Of course, they don't always mean that. Like if they tell you it's a nominal fee to park, $26 is not nominal, okay? A dollar is nominal. Nominal means in name only, right? It's like the word anonymous, right? And the nominalists of the Middle Ages, right, they were Christians, but they were saying there are no universal things at all. Everything's a particular. The words we use, like good, true, just, those are just names, nothing more, right? And we need to be careful because if you're like me, most Christians always love to mention William of Ockham because we love this thing called Occam's razor because it helps us fight the Darwinists, okay? And that's really cool, but Ockham was a nominalist and he's a little bit dangerous. You got to be careful. I won't go so far to call him a heretic, but it's certainly heterodox. And luckily we had people like Aquinas and Dante, the new Plato and Aristotle, to put them in their place. And just, I want to show you how much things have changed in our modern world. Do you know what the position of Plato was called? The position that believed that there is goodness, truth, and beauty? That was called realism. Now, today, when you say realism, you think that somebody that watches Martin Scorsese movies or something, where everybody's getting killed or something, that's realistic, blood and hair on the wall or something. No, that's not what they meant by realistic. Realism meant there are real things. Not nothing exists, but real things exist, and they are the origin and the source of everything. They were called the realists. The people that denied the existence of universal things were called nominalists because our words, like justice, are only names. Right? So again, they've existed, but they were stopped as well. And they were also stopped by the reformers and things like that. Okay, now what I want to do in the rest of this, though, to kind of bring it to today, is I want to talk about C.S. Lewis, and I want to talk about something that most of you probably know about C.S. Lewis, but I hope that in the context of the speech today, you will see how C.S. Lewis, in the mode and legacy of Plato and the Bible, is still answering the same sophistical argument that there are no standards of goodness, truth, and beauty. And Lewis is most famous for arguing that there is a standard of goodness, of what is good or bad, moral or immoral, virtuous or vicious. And most of you have heard the word the Tao, T-A-O. That's a word that he uses in The Abolition of Man, but the same argument he makes about the Tao is made in Book 1 of Mere Christianity. And most of what I'm going to say now, this is the second part of your handout. And if you didn't find it, I've got a very detailed handout, so you don't have to take too many notes. It's all there. There won't be a test, or maybe there will be. Okay, we'll see. What I want to show is Lewis's idea of morality. Now, Mere Christianity is his most famous work of apologetics. And he wants to begin that work by making common ground between people who are already Christians and already believe in the Bible and secular people who don't believe in the Bible and don't believe in the Christian revelation. Where is a point of intersection? Where is the bridge between Athens and Jerusalem? Where is the bridge that I can touch someone who doesn't accept the Bible as an authority? And he begins by basically telling us, did you ever notice that when two people disagree about something, they argue about it rather than fight? Now, there are some people that fight, most of Washington, okay? But most people do not resort to fists. Most people argue. And Lewis says, if you listen to people argue, they say things like, that's not right. No, I'm better at this. And we don't realize it, but when we argue with someone, to have a real argument with someone, both of you have to agree to a standard. You might not even be conscious that you're doing it, but you can't have an argument unless the two of you have agreed that a standard exists, and basically I'm saying my argument better fulfills that standard, and you say, no, I come closer to that standard. Otherwise, if the standard didn't exist, you couldn't have... Anybody, when somebody says that's right or that's wrong, that doesn't mean anything unless there's a standard, right? If somebody cuts you off on the road while you're driving and you both get out of your car and you say, you cut me off, no, you cut me, no, and you go back and forth. But notice that nobody says, well, actually, I cut you off because I'm allowed to do that. Now, if somebody said that, you know what you would do? You would take them to an asylum, okay? Right? Send them to Manhattan or L.A. or something. But the, both of them understand that it's wrong to cut someone off. But they're arguing as to who is right and who is wrong, who better fits the standard. Now, it's a little more complicated than that. I might say to you, well, yes, I admit, technically speaking, I cut you off. But if you had been an attentive driver, you would have seen the 18-wheeler barreling down on me, and you would have slowed down so I can move over in time. Right? Now, see, I'm admitting I did something wrong, but there were extenuating circumstances. And I'm still working within a set of rules that are commonly understood. Now, Lewis wanted a name. He said that there is a universal cross-cultural moral ethical code. It exists, and we know it exists, even if we don't know it consciously. And so he didn't have to keep saying that. In The Abolition of Man, he used the word the Tao, T-A-O. Now, we know you're supposed to say Tao, but you know the British anglicize everything, okay? How do they say Don Quixote? Don Quixote? Don Juan? They say Marquis. You know what that is? Marquis, Marquis. Now, I agree in always mispronouncing French words on purpose, but the, but, you know, but I like to pronounce Spanish words right. Don Juan, that's cool. Don Juan, okay. So he would have said Tao, even though it is Tao, like Taoism, but it's spelled T-A-O. And why did Lewis use a word from a form of Buddhism or Confucianism? Why did he use that? Well, he's showing us that it's universal and cross-cultural. Now, most of you, did any of you grow up in the public school and they were enamored of yin and yang? Everybody talks about that, right? I mean, yin and yang in and of itself is really not Christian, right? It's borders on the relativism. But here's what's cool. Even though the Taoists talked about, you know, yin with the little black and the white with the little white, they still believe that above yin and yang was this shadowy thing that they called the Tao. It means the way. So even in a system that seems to be very relativistic, they still understand that there's something above that, that there is an ultimate origin, the way, the Tao, right? And Taoism comes from that. And so Lewis wants us to understand that that moral code exists. And the best way to prove this, if there was no Tao, if there was no universal moral ethical code that transcended all people and all cultures, then we could not have held the Nuremberg trials. You've heard of that? That's when they put the Nazi war criminals on trial. Now, you cannot have a Nuremberg trial unless you have tacitly accepted three things. Number one, a standard actually exists. If there is no standard, then who's to say whether democratic or Nazi ethics are better? Right? So it means there's a standard. Watch this. It also means that those war criminals knew the standard and yet broke it anyway. If we really believed that the Nazi war criminals had no idea that what they were doing is wrong, what would we do with them? We wouldn't execute them. We wouldn't put them in prison. We would put them where? In an insane asylum, okay? We recognize immediately, right? Like, I hope none of you suffer. Every so often, you have these children who are born without that moral thing, and I've met a few parents, and it's very, very difficult because they seem to be missing that moral sense, and it's very, very hard to train them. And I don't know, you know, remember, we live in a broken world, okay? But folks, the fact that some people are born unable to walk, that doesn't disprove that legs were meant for walking. It's the exception that proves the rule. We recognize the brokenness of the person who can't walk because we understand that legs are naturally meant for walking. So just like people are born with broken bodies, some people are born with broken souls, if you will. I don't understand why. We live in a fallen world, right? There are some people that are born sociopaths or psychopaths. But that's the minority that is the exception that proves the rule, right? We say if the 9/11 guys had survived, we would have put them on trial. And if they said, I didn't know it was wrong, again, we probably would not believe them. We might put them in an asylum, but more likely we would not believe them and punish them. Right? So we know it exists. And you know what? If you want a definition of the Tao, I'll give you the easiest definition. The Tao is the way you expect other people to treat you. Right? I don't care if you are 100% French deconstructionist, relativist, don't believe there are any standards. If somebody cuts in front of you online, you're going to get mad. And if he says, in my culture, it's okay to do that, you're going to buy that? I'm not going to buy it, okay? I know you're wrong, okay? We understand that that code exists. There is a good, just as there is a true and a beautiful. Lewis is trying to show us, using a sort of argument that doesn't even rely on the Bible. It's just basic logic, basic human behavior shows you that it exists. Now, we break it all the time. That's where guilt comes from. Guilt is not the problem. Guilt is a signal that we've broken the Tao, right? And we know that. And so we keep wanting to insulate ourselves, and we were trying to trick our conscience, trying to trick our feeling of guilt and make that the problem. But we know it's wrong. We wouldn't fight so hard. The lady doth protest too much, is the famous line in Hamlet, right? We get mad, right? Have you ever met a person who, if you accuse them of something and they're innocent, they'll get mad at you? But if you accuse them of something of which they're guilty, they'll get really mad at you. That might be your husband or wife, I don't know. Okay. But we know these things exist. It's just common sense. We could not have arguments. Now, what I want to do in the end here, keep an eye on my time. Oh, I've got some time, okay. Let me quickly go over some of the critiques of Lewis and how Lewis answers that. Now, some of you, when I said that morality is not only universal, but it's cross-cultural, a lot of you should have felt deep inside of you, especially if you're older, if you're my age or older, no, that's wrong. No, that's wrong. No, morality is completely different from culture to culture. Do you know who taught you that? Do you know who taught you that notion, which is actually not true? It is the anthropologist. Margaret Mead wrote a famous book called Coming of Age in Samoa. That book has been sort of disproven and discredited for 20, 30 years, but people still think it's true, right? Herodotus thought it was true. He wasn't always right, that morality is wildly different. The rules of propriety change, you know, as Lewis puts it this way. There are some societies that let you have four wives instead of one, but nobody says you can have anybody you want. Right? Now, sometimes a king will take any woman he wants, but everybody lets him do it because he's above the law. But they understand it's wrong, and it always leads to trouble anyway. Right? Do you know what the Bible verse that is against bigamy? It says, no man can serve two masters. Okay, so that's the proof against bigamy. But anyway, I don't have time for a lot of jokes, so let's throw them in there quick. So much to cover. But So you need to understand that it's not true, okay? And of course, most of us know it because Margaret Mead talked about sexual things and we get all in. But no, cultural morality is pretty standard from place to place. And if you buy a copy of The Abolition of Man, which is a very short book, in The Abolition of Man, there's a famous appendix where Lewis goes through all the major cultures and looks at all their major law codes, the Greeks, the Romans, the Norsemen, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Native American Indians, the Aborigines in Australia. He looks at all the different groups and lines them up, and all of them have a basic understanding of the Ten Commandments. They all have a basic understanding of morality. It is pretty standard across because we all have a conscience. It's been built into us. Let me show you the problem of the modern world. The sophists did this, and we're going back to it. Imagine you were sitting in your backyard, and you heard a whirring sound, and you look up, and a Martian spaceship lands in your backyard. And a Martian gets out, and using a universal translator, says, I would like to understand humanity. Help me. Would you take him by his tentacle and lead him to the nearest insane asylum? I hope you wouldn't, but that's what we do now, right? We've taken what used to be marginal stuff and moved it to the center and took the center and moved it out to the margin. The new normal is what they call it today. That's dumb. It's not true. I mean, oh, man, who we make fun of? You married?
Yes, sir.
Okay, what's it? Jim. If Jim is up here and he's telling you about his wife and by mistake he says, my mother, okay, what are all of you thinking in the room? This guy has an unresolved Oedipal complex. We better not let him take care of the children in Sunday school, right? Now, that's bad enough, but this happened to anybody. If Jim's giving this speech, while he's continuing his speech, you know what he's saying to himself in the back part of his head? Oh my gosh, I do have an I'm Hamlet, okay? Something like that. Now, what do we call those things? What am I talking about? We call that a Freudian slip, right? I want you to know something, that 200 years ago, nobody did that, okay? People didn't do that. Freud messed up our mind, so we're always second-guessing ourselves. I'm weird. See, there used to be this wonderful time, not that long ago, when there was this beautiful circle. And you know what the name of that circle was? Normalcy, okay? And most of us were in the circle. But out on the margin of the circle were somebody that had a neurosis or a psychosis or a phobia. Nowadays, since Freud particularly, if you are normal, if that even exists, you're way out on the margin because everybody has a neurosis or a psychosis or a phobia. But we've done that. We've done this to ourselves. We've twisted ourselves around. We've turned morality upside down. But it still persists. Was it Horace that said, when you kick nature out the front door, it comes back in the back door? Was it Horace or one of those guys? You could probably say it in Latin. No, I don't know if you can. Okay, but some of you know it in Latin. Okay. You could just say gibberish and I'll believe you, you know. It's wonderful. But just say anything you want, right? Great stuff. But but this is what we've done in our world. We've sort of blinded ourselves to normalcy. Now, you know what? In our human population, there are people that are born as psychopaths and sociopaths. And every so often, you might find an isolated tribe with a backwards morality. But that's the exception that proves the rule. You know what the problem with social psychology is? They do all of their studies either in Manhattan or LA. These are not normal people. These are not normal people, okay? So, I think we need a new thing called the Electoral College for Social Science, okay? Social psychology, better known as Common Sense 101. But anyway, again, we've got to break from this idea that's been grammed. It's just not true. Basic morality is understood across the board, right? All right, now some people might say to Lewis, well, wait a minute, you're talking about this Tao, you're saying that it's, you know, comes from God, basically, because it's got to be supernatural, right? No, what you're calling a divine code, that's just a man-made thing made up by wise men, sages, prophets, holy men. They make up all of this stuff. And Lewis said, that's actually not true. Do you know what you call a prophet who makes up his own morality? You know what you call him? You call him David Koresh. You call him a false prophet, okay? The role of a true prophet, and this would include a Buddha or a Confucius or a Socrates or a Gandhi or something. Their job is not to make up the Tao, but to remind us of the Tao that we already know. That's the real role. When they start going off wild, we realize that they're a crank or a cultic figure or something. But, and again, in as much as Jesus was a prophet, his teachings are not that different from the other prophets. Now, he was more than that. Obviously, we believe he was the Son of God. But as much as he was a prophet, now, most people, even secular people, would agree that the Sermon on the Mount is probably the most perfect embodiment of the moral ethical code, but it is not radically different from other ones across culture because God gave us a conscience. It exists, and we know it, and we recognize it right away. Now, some people say, wait a minute, of course morality is man-made. We have to teach it to our children. That sounds like a pretty strong argument. But wait a minute, we also have to teach our children the mathematical tables. Do we make up math? Math is not something we make up. Math is something we discover. Math is already there and we discover it. It's the same way with morality. The moral ethical code, what Lewis called the Tao, it is there and we need to teach it to our children and instill it, but it's already there. That doesn't mean we're making it up. Now, the strongest argument, though, is to say, no. What you're calling the Tao, all of that is a natural instinct, right? Animals, too, have natural instincts. Natural instinct to preserve your life, to procreate, a natural desire to save your tribe or save your family. And Lewis said, well, that's true. We are also partly animal in that sense. We all have natural urges and natural drives, okay? But then Lewis counters and says, but what happens when two different natural instincts come into conflict? How do you choose which one to follow? Well, if I'm trying to choose between natural instinct X and natural instinct Y, I can't figure it out by appealing to natural instinct Z. That's not going to do me any good. If I'm playing the piano and I want to know what the next note is, I can't figure it out by appealing to the keys. I have to look at the score, right? So the only way we can decide between X or Y is by appealing to a higher law, to the Tao. If I have to decide whether to save myself or save my family, I've got to appeal to something that is not a desire. Lewis calls it a third thing, a tertium quid. It's a touchstone. It's something above. That's the only way that you can resolve your conflict. Okay, so it exists. We know it. We don't want to admit it, but it exists. That's why we feel guilty. See, that's, you know, the part of the whole LGBT thing is saying that the reason why there's such high suicide and drug abuse in that community is because we enforce guilt upon them. But you know, there's no guilt left in the Netherlands. They're still having all those problems, okay? There's something inside of us. Just like pain signals that I've used my arms in a wrong way and have exerted too much force on them and I'm going to break my bones. In the same way, guilt is a signal that you have broken not the laws of nature, but the laws of the Tao, the laws of morality, right? Now, nature follows the laws of nature. We follow the laws of human nature. You know what? This is just simple. But the proof that a Tao exists, Lewis said, is that we use words like ought and should and could. Animals know nothing about ought or should. They follow their instincts and that's it, right? But we are choosing creatures. We are moral, ethical creatures who choose what we ought. Now, sometimes we know what we ought to, but we don't do it, right? Right? What was the little thing from Mel Brooks? I just got back from an auto de fe. What's an auto de fe? It's what you oughtn't to do, but you do anyway. You can watch that. That's Torquemada. But we know when we break the Tao. And again, even if we refuse to accept it, we expect everybody else to follow it. You get mad when someone else breaks the Tao. Okay, let me end quickly. I think I just have a few more minutes. Yeah, let me end quickly here because Lewis, in the manner of Plato, not only is going to explain it to us logically, what I've gone through, he also incarnates it in a story. Because you know what? Lewis has his own version of Plato's allegory of the cave, and it appears in The Silver Chair, which is one of the Chronicles of Narnia. Has anybody ever taught The Silver Chair? Some of you taught that? Wonderful. Okay. In The Silver Chair, we've got two Earth children, Eustace and Jill, and together with this guy named Puddleglum, this Marshwiggle, they have to rescue Prince Rillian, who is the son of King Caspian. And Prince Rillian has been kidnapped and held in the underground world of this terrible green witch. And she has kept him as a prisoner there. And towards the end of the book, our heroes find the prince, break the silver chair, set him free, and they're about to leave and go back to Narnia, right back to the earth, when the witch catches them. Now, the first time you read the book, you think the witch is going to try to zap them or kill them or something, but she doesn't. She closes the door and locks it. Then she goes over to the fire. She removes some green dust and throws it in the fire. And immediately, the air grows thick and heavy and soporific, and everybody gets sleepy. And the witch says, and the witch takes out a mandolin, which she begins to strum rhythmically. And she says, "Where are you going, children?" "We're going back to Narnia." "Narnia? What is Narnia?" "Up there, up there? You mean the ceiling? There is no up there. This is the world. What do you mean?" "Well, up there where the sun shines." "Sun? What a peculiar word. Do you mean anything by it?" "You see that torch?" "Yes, well, imagine if that torch got bigger and bigger and bigger and it hung from the ceiling. That's the sun." "Oh, I see. We're playing a game. You looked at a torch and wondered what it would be like if it got bigger and bigger, and you invented this thing called sun. Well, it's really a pretty game, but you're too old for such games, children." "Strum." "Well, there's Aslan." "Aslan? What a peculiar name. What's an Aslan?" "Well, he's a lion." "Lion? Do you mean anything by the word?" "Well, have you ever seen a cat?" "Oh, I love cats, because the evil villains always love cats." Mr. Bond, okay? Ernst Stavro Blofeld, who I guess is Greek with that name, but anyway. I love cat. Well, imagine if the cat got bigger and bigger and it had a mane like a horse. That's a lion. Oh, I see. We're playing the game again. Right? You saw a cat and wondered what it would be. Children, this is a childish game. It's time to put away childish things and become part of my world, the only world there is. Now, you understand what Lewis is doing. He is redoing Plato's allegory of the cave, but he's actually doing Plato one better. And I say that with fear and trembling. He's actually doing Plato one better. What is the difference between the prisoners in the cave and our good characters? You know what the difference is? Difference is, good. The difference is they've actually been outside. They've seen the sun. They've felt it. They've met, not all of them, but most of them have met Aslan. They know what a lion is. They know it's real. And yet, in a matter of 5 minutes, that witch is able to convince them that everything they know is real, that they have handled, that they've touched, I'm quoting the gospel there, what they've touched is not real anymore. Now, I don't know whether Lewis meant this or not, but that is a very scary metaphor for what could happen to some of you in this room. Those of you who have dedicated so much time and energy, homeschooling, classical school, a mixture of both, you've put money, you've put time, so you can raise your children in the faith, you work hard, and then when they turn 18, for a little bit of vanity, you send them to Harvard so they can destroy everything you did in 1 month. Now, folks, if your child is called into the secular world, we are called, okay? But don't just take for granted that's where God wants your kid. Send them to Houston Baptist University. We'll take care of them. There's a lot of good schools out there, okay? A lot of good schools. There's Grove City. There's Hillsdale. There's lots of good schools. Patrick Henry. There's all sorts of schools that are still Wheaton and Biola that are still grounded in the Christian worldview. And you need to understand, if your kids go to a secular school, tell them they must get fellowship, and not just with a church, with a college group of other college students who are facing, because churches are great, but churches are not geared to help college students. That's not their job. Their job is to help families, the parents, the kids, the youths. They can't put all their money in people who are here today and gone tomorrow, right? So they need to join a Christian campus group that focuses on campus concern, because I went to secular schools. What happens is, they don't attack your faith in a logical way. There's no debate. They just make you believe that your faith is Santa Claus. They make you believe that that's childish and you have to go. And it's so fast that all that Christianity seems unreal. It's not that it sounds untrue. It sounds unreal. And you need fellowship. Your kids must have that fellowship to hold them together, right? But we've got to be careful. This world has tried to convince us that what we know is true is not true. The sophists did it 2,500 years ago. The modern new atheists are doing it today. Nothing has changed. It's the same old game plan. Whether it's a green witch in a fantasy novel or whether it's a professor at a secular university or Baylor. No, just joking. Anyway, just having fun. Oh, before I end, let me make my announcements. I always forget my announcements. Really quickly. Some really cool stuff. Eighth Day Books has like 10 of my books over there. Okay? And including Atheism on Trial. So after I finish speaking, I'm going to go over there if you want to sign any books. All the books are there except the books that I did with Canon Press, Worldview Guides to the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the Aeneid. Those are inside the hall. Just get it and come out to Eighth Day Books and I'll sign those. Also, really quickly, some of you know my book, From Achilles to Christ. Okay, well, I just wrote a sequel called The Myth Made Fact, Reading Greek Mythology Through Christian Eyes, and I just signed a contract with Classical Academic Press last week, okay? And they're really jumping into this, so look for that. It will help you teach mythology. Also, this is really exciting, and I'll end with this. Anybody read Christianity Today here? That's like the evangelical flagship paper. I've read it. They've never had a major article on the classical Christian movement, so I spent all spring writing it. And they made me rewrite it and rewrite it and rewrite it. And I finally got it right. They finally accepted it. They'll publish it sometime in the fall. So look for that. It's about the whole movement. It includes university model schools. It includes classical charter schools. Everything's in there because we got to get the word out about what we are doing, that we are forming children. And we're not brainwashing children. We're forming children to understand the Christian worldview so they won't be so easily fooled by the same tactics they've been around for 2,500 years. Satan's not a very creative person. It's the same thing over and over again, telling us that what we know is real is not real, and yet we believe it. I don't know how, but we're convinced because we want to fit in or something like that, and we lose all of that. So let me close in prayer. And again, I'll go over to 8th Day Bookshare if you have questions. And tomorrow at 3, I keep saying 2:50, is it? But let me just close in prayer. Father God, we thank you so much, especially for the teachers in this room and the homeschooling moms that are working so hard to instill in their students and instill in their children what the good, the true, and the beautiful really are. To teach them not only what they are in the abstract, but that they are real. That truth is not just an idea, but it is a person. I am the way, the truth, and the life. Father, help us to shine your light in a world that wants to shove us back into the cave, into a world of illusions. Father, give us the courage and the wisdom to stand up for goodness, truth, and beauty, but in a way that is attractive and that brings awe and wonder and gratitude. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Thank you all. I'll head over there if you have any questions. Thank you all.